The B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word of God, the B-I-B-L-E.
The B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word.
Hey, Bob. What are you doing?
Nothing. Just cleaning up a little.
Well, good morning. Like Russell said earlier, we are so incredibly excited that you guys are here with us as we plunge ahead into week three of this series that we are calling The Bible for Grownups. And if you're here with us for the very first time this morning during this series, or maybe you're checking us out online for the first time during this series, you are here on an incredible weekend. But what we also believe is this: you've also missed a couple of incredible weekends as we have moved through this journey in this series. You see, this entire series revolves around this concept, this tension that every single one of us have faced in our lives. That at some point in our journey, no matter where we find ourselves on this spectrum in our relationship with God, whether we walked in here this morning and we've been going to church for the last 65 years, or we walked in here this morning and we want absolutely nothing to do with God, no matter what our history looks like, every single one of us in this room have come face to face with doubts in our faith that were predicated on this book. That there have been moments in our past, moments in our history, where we have struggled to understand it, where we've struggled to defend it, and more often than not, where we have struggled to believe it. And maybe for some of us, the reason why we have struggled so much with this book comes back to the fact that many of us in this room know some stories in the Bible, right? No matter where you are on that spectrum, when you walked in here, like, you've heard the story of Jesus going to the cross and raising again, or you've heard the story of David and Goliath, or you've heard the story of Adam and Eve. You've heard stories of the Bible, but you've never really heard the stories about the backstory of the Bible. And what I believe with all of my heart is this, is that oftentimes the backstory of the Bible is almost as important as what's written in it. That for many of us, the challenge we face in our lives revolves around this truth. That if you don't know the story of the Bible, it becomes really easy to discount the stories in the Bible. Every single one of us have been there, that when we don't fully understand why this book was written or how this book came to be, it becomes really easy for us to discount the truth and the validity and the power and the relevance of the stories and what's written inside of this book. See, all of us, in not really knowing this book, have our doubts stoked. And maybe for some of us, we walked into this room in a completely different place. It's not our doubts and our questions that we're presently dealing with, but we're trying to answer the questions and the doubts of our kids, or we're trying to answer the questions and the doubts of our grandkids and what they're walking through and what they're bumping up against every day of their life in school, what they bump up against in their workplaces or in colleges. And we're trying to figure out how we answer those questions. Because as we walk out into this world, what becomes prevalent is this, is we can hear plenty of stories about what else this book says. That we've heard all the stories about all the things they don't talk about in church that this book says. And every single one of those things that we hear in the world around us is supposed to be a blemish into what we testify God is supposed to be all about, or how relevant and valid this book is supposed to be right here in our lives. We've all heard those takes, but what we haven't heard is the real side of the story. What we haven't heard is the other side, filled with facts and historical context that allows us to grasp onto truth, that points back to the reality that this book is still powerful and true and relevant in our lives right here, right now, today. But every single week of this series, what I've outlined is this, is that there are two major expectations that every single one of us must understand. Two major expectations that we must understand in order for us to walk out of this room actually having gotten something out of the message this morning. The first is this, is that what you need to understand is that this series is unlike any other that we do around here. You see, most of the time we focus our Sunday mornings and our efforts, and specifically my messages, around the concept of application of what this book says. How do we apply it to our marriages, our parenting? How do we apply it to the things we walk through every single day? But what we've acknowledged in this series is this, is that the practical application in this book is useless unless we can first believe that this book is true, right? That if this book isn't true and what's written in it can't be believed, then the practical application in it is, at its worst, hypocrisy. That there's no reason for us to follow through on it. And so this series, at first, is this acknowledgement for us to go back and for us to be able to cling to facts and historical context that point to the truth in that book. And so it's going to have a little bit different feeling, and you're going to get to hear me geek out a little bit, and every week is going to be a journey through history, a journey back at story after story and fact after fact. And so I'm asking you, I'm challenging you to lean into that just a little bit, even if that's not the style that you directly connect with. The second expectation is this, is that every week of this series is exactly what I said, a journey. It's a different puzzle piece coming together in this story. And what we want to acknowledge for you is this, is that at the end of every single week, all of your dilemmas will not be answered. All of your doubts will not magically go away as it pertains to this book. We will leave here this morning and there will still be open-ended questions. And there won't be a perfect bow tie on the end until we get to next week. But this morning is an opportunity for us to put another piece in the puzzle, for us to understand. And it's the reason why, as we move through every piece that's being put into the puzzle, every new answer to every question and doubt, that I challenge you, if you haven't been here for the first 2 weeks of this series, to go back on our podcast and to listen to it, or to go back online and to watch the first 2 weeks to help you get context and facts into why we can believe that this book is true and historically accurate in everything that it says. But let me give you a little recap. 2 weeks ago, we kicked off this series by acknowledging this truth, that the story of the Bible doesn't actually begin within the beginning. The story of the Bible actually begins just after it is finished. You see, the story of the Bible really begins when this one Jewish man didn't do what dead men do: stay dead. The story of the Bible really begins when hundreds, if not thousands of people saw Jesus come back to life and walk on this earth. That in that moment where this faith was reignited, this movement was sparked again, that these men got this bright idea that what they saw happen had to be written down. It had to be documented. It had to be shared with the entire world. And in that moment, we don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead because the Bible tells us so. We believe Jesus rose from the dead because men actually saw it happen and they wrote it down. And in many cases, they gave their lives for it. It's the reason why we have these collections of documents to this day. And then we continued the story last week, that on the heels of the story of the life of this one Jewish man named Jesus, as these Christ followers began to take the story of this life out into the Roman and Greek world, they encountered Gentiles who slowly became enamored with the story of this one Jewish man. And when they became enamored with the story of this one Jewish man, you know what else happened? They became enamored with the ancient Jewish text that pointed to this one Jewish man in the future. And as they became enamored with the ancient Jewish text, they did what all of us would do. They busted out the ancient Jewish text and they began to read them. And when they busted open those scrolls and they started at the beginning with the account that we read in Genesis, what they read after those three vital words in the beginning absolutely shook them to their core. Because there was something introduced in that creation account that you and I have heard and read that they had never experienced before. There was this account that introduced a brand new worldview that no other religion had ever introduced. An account that began with the creation by one God. Not many, as the Greek and Roman world were accustomed to, not many like the Babylonian and Canaanite and Egyptian ancient texts alluded to. No, one God who created all of this at the snap of a finger. One God who in his creation of all that is and was in this world made one thing the pinnacle of his creation. Us. In this creation account, humanity was not the afterthought. Humanity was the central part of the story. A God who loved us so much that when he created us, guess what he did? He gave every man, woman, and child dignity, value, and worth by creating them as image bearers of the Creator. He put a piece of himself in us as humanity. Are you kidding me? No other religion, no other creation story has a God who loves his people like that. In every other ancient creation story, you know what happens? We are the afterthought, made so that the gods don't have to do anything. That's not this story. We have a God who loved us enough to give us the freedom of choice. And then, check this out, immediately went to work on a plan to fix the messes that our personal choices got us into. A story of a God who loved us so much that when things got messiest at just the right time, he chose to join us. That's a worldview, that's scientific fact. The scientific community and the world at large didn't begin to catch up to until the 20th century. It's something that is unprecedented and unbelievable. It's something that's absolutely amazing to our faith. But what has happened over the years is this. Is we become accustomed to just believing or assuming that God created the world. And so we begin to believe, well, the Genesis creation account, the purpose of it wasn't for us to know that God created all of us and that God loved us. No, 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 we assume that. So the purpose must have been to tell us how God did it. And for many of us, that throws us off track. Because Moses' initial primary purpose was not to tell us how God created the world, but was to show us that God created the world with us at the center of the story. And until we see that side of the story, we will always look at the creation account in the wrong way. And today, that's where we pick up the story. Today, that's where we move forward. And we move forward in this light. Understanding that if you're anything like me, your dilemma with the Old Testament does not end in the beginning. Am I right? That the questions and the doubts that you have encountered in your life, in your past, maybe that you're wrestling with right now, aren't solely on the creation account. They are much deeper than that. They extend much further into the Old Testament than that. That as we've sat in our college philosophy classes, that as we've heard bits and pieces of what else the Bible says, and we've contemplated questions of how can I trust in a God who allows that to happen in the Old Testament, or who acts in that way, or allows his people to go through those messes, our viewpoint and our worldview begins to shift along the lines of writers like Richard Dawkins. You see, Richard Dawkins takes bits and pieces of the story of the Old Testament and begins to formulate a belief that this God of the Jewish world that is the same God of our Christian faith really isn't a God worth following, really isn't a God we can trust based upon the messes that we see in the Old Testament. And some of us, in our doubts and in our struggles, have found ourselves slowly swaying, or have found our kids slowly swaying over to the belief that's much like what Richard Dawkins writes in his book, The God Delusion. He comes up with this synopsis of who he believes God really is, the God of the Jews, that is the God of the Christian faith, and the flaws that are in this God that make him unbelievable and untrustable to you and I right here in 2021. And I wanted you to see what Richard Dawkins wrote. In his book, this is a small excerpt from it of what he concludes about our God. He writes this: Judaism is simply this. It's originally a tribal cult of a single fiercely unpleasant God, morbidly obsessed with sexual restrictions, with the smell of charred flesh. And Richard Dawkins goes on and on and on with width after width after width in that statement of all the issues we find with our God in the Old Testament. And if you haven't learned this already throughout this series, we're a church that's not afraid to address the other side of the story, not afraid to address or ignore the skeptics in the equation. That this is what Richard Dawkins sees when he cracks open bits and pieces of the Old Testament. And here's what's crazy. For every single one of us in this room, if this is all you read and somebody pulled out bits and pieces of the Old Testament and showed them to you, guess what? I would not blame you for beginning to think, why in the world would anybody take this book and this God seriously? I get it. And that's why I wanted to stop and talk about this. Because what I believe with all of my heart is that what guys like Richard Dawkins and others like him believe about our God and the Old Testament is absolutely 100% wrong. That they haven't looked at the entire picture. That they've only looked at the bits and pieces that they've wanted to see to draw their conclusions that point away from God, instead of looking at the historical context that allows us to see God in the correct light. But in order for us to get there, we have to see the full picture. And so this morning, in the next 20 minutes, what I want to do for you is this, is I want to give you a more complete picture of the Old Testament, of the God that we see in here, and an explanation for the rough edges that we see around this God that raise our doubts to an unbearable level. You see, the recap really begins in the first five books of the Old Testament. Have you ever picked up this book and attempted to read the first five books before? What you found is this, right? You crack it open and you start to read Genesis and you're like, oh, there's some pretty good stories in here, right? There's the creation account in here and we get Adam and Eve, and then we go forward and we get Abraham and the creation of a new nation and the promise of a nation. And we get Noah and the flood's kind of weird and it's kind of bad, but then it ends on a good note and there's the rainbow and everything's good and God's never going to do that again. And then we progress forward and things are good because we get the story of Joseph, right? And like, he's got those nasty brothers that all of us have gotten, and we thought our brothers were going to sell us into slavery a time or two. But then Moses rises into power and he like sticks the finger in their face without sticking the finger in their face of like, look what I was able to do. Like, I told you y'all were going to bow down to me, and all that happens. And he rises to be one of the most powerful rulers in all of Egypt, and he saves all of his family and saves the entire world from the famine that they're going through. And then we progress to the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus. And the story changes in theme a little bit, but it's still kind of interesting, right? Like, at this point, all of the nation of Israel has been taken as slaves to Egypt. And they live in captivity, they live in bondage for over 400 years. Scholars believe approximately 430 years they are in slavery to Egypt. But then at the end of this story, right, we get Moses like stomping into Pharaoh's palace and he says, let my people go. And it comes on the heel of like these 10 plagues. And finally, Pharaoh relents and they go out into the wilderness and God does some incredible things on their quest towards this land that he's promised them to live in and rule over. He parts the Red Seas and they're all starving in the middle of the desert, and he sends manna down every single morning, but only enough for the day so that you can trust me. And if you try to store it in little Ziploc baggies, it's going to be rotten by the next day. And so you just trust that I'm going to send more. And it's good, and everything's great. And then there's this moment as they're wandering in the wilderness where Moses goes up to Mount Sinai. And he comes down, right, with these two giant pieces of rock with things written on them that we know as the Ten Commandments. It was Moses, not Charlton Heston. Yes, Moses came down. But what we don't see about the story is when Moses went up Mount Sinai, he got what's known as the Sinai Covenant, and Moses came down with more than just the Ten Commandments. In fact, Moses came down with this entirely new covenant that God was giving to his people that consisted of 613 laws. 613 changes that God wanted his people to put into practice in their lives that were different from the surrounding nations and what they were presently practicing. And as we progress through Exodus, what we see is we come to Leviticus. And if you've ever read through Leviticus, you're like, what? And then you go to Numbers and you're like, what? And then you go to Deuteronomy and you're like, didn't we just read this in Leviticus? But Leviticus, if you were like, what in the world is going on here? I don't understand this. That's where we get the outline of the 613 different laws. Leviticus is chocked full of this new covenant that God has passed down. And in the middle of Leviticus is the place in which guys like Richard Dawkins takes their most severe stance against God. It's where they find their greatest issues. Because at face value, guys like Richard Dawkins flip to the book of Leviticus chapter 18, and what do they see in Leviticus chapter 18? A God who hands down 19 new sexual restrictions, 19 sexual prohibitions. And you're like, yeah, Richard Dawkins was right. That's exactly why I'm not religious. Because there goes God again, sticking his nose in my business, telling me what I can and can't do in the bedroom. And at face value, it's really easy to believe that. But this morning, I wanted to stop because that's not the whole story. On top of, I thought I'd stop in the middle because anytime the pastor says something about sex, everybody tunes in a little bit closer. But what's crazy about this side of the story is this. Out of the 19 sexual prohibitions in Leviticus 18 that God hands down in the Sinai covenant, check this out. In our present day world, 17 out of the 19 sexual restrictions in every major country of the world are either illegal or heavily frowned upon within culture. Isn't that crazy? That this is what we get, and Richard Dawkins just pulls pieces and parts out and wants you to see a side of the story without researching it more. But what we get is that it was something that was vastly different from what was happening in the world around it, and it would take centuries, thousands of years in some cases, for the rest of the world to catch up to it. But eventually, the rest of the world came to see that the Sinai Covenant was way, 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 way ahead of its time. And actually a healthy approach to the way in which we do life in many ways. But Moses, in his attempt to lay down these 19 sexual restrictions in the Sinai Covenant, he outlines it perfectly in Leviticus chapter 18, verse 6. And I wanted to show you guys this to see if you saw this the same way I did and we're in agreement with this. And so that's where we're going to dive into this morning. If you haven't done so already, it's a perfect time for you to grab your weekly. It's what you got when you came in, and to pull that notes page out of the center. You can follow along with us as we move through the text. Even grab a pen from the seat back in front of you or behind you, and you can fill in some blanks as you struggle with doubts and questions that you have in the weeks and months to come. But here is how Moses outlines these ridiculous sexual restrictions that God hands down, in which he's getting into everybody's business. This is what God's trying to do. Can you believe this? In verse 6, it says, "You must never have sexual relations with a close relative." And after that, you know what we get? Don't have sex with your mom. Don't have sex with your grandma. Don't have sex with a daughter. Don't have sex with an aunt on your dad's side. Don't have sex with an aunt on your mom's side. And I don't know about you, but for me, it seems pretty reasonable, right? I mean, I'm guessing it does to you as well. It doesn't seem that far-fetched. But here's the crazy part, and this takes us back to the historical context. 1,500 years after Moses brings down the Sinai Covenant, The Roman and the Greek world at that time are living according to all of these sexual restrictions. But you go just a little bit over into Egypt, and guess what's happening? 1,500 years later, the Egyptian monarchy still believes that all of these things are baloney. And they're marrying brothers and marrying sisters and having kids with family members. And the crumbling of the Egyptian monarchy centers on their inability to adhere to these things. That it was absolute disaster after a while when they started marrying brothers and sisters and partaking in incest and thinking that they could keep it all in the family to keep the monarchy going. It didn't work out the way that they wanted. And there's this reality that oftentimes we fly right over the Sinai covenant with this belief. God is so old-fashioned. Just read some of this. We have a God who in this passage, it becomes very clear how narrow-minded he is. And guys, what we miss is that's not the entire truth of this. We haven't seen the entire picture when we just come to those conclusions based upon what some other dude or this bit and piece and this bit and piece says in it. It's not that simple. There was more to the story. And here's what's so cool. When we really look at the Sinai covenant in the Old Testament, it was a moral and civil code that when understood in its ancient context was absolutely brilliant. Like when you really look at the entire thing, it was this moral and civil code that when we understand what was happening in the nations around at that time and what the Israelites were walking through at that time, what was happening in that world, this covenant was absolutely brilliant for its day and age. It was something that would take some nations thousands of years to recognize the significance of following some of these mandates. And the problem is so often, like even non-religious, non-Christians, historians and scholars, if you ask them this question, I'll guarantee what answer you get. Is it ever wise for me to pull something that was written out of its ancient context and to compare it to present times? Is that a smart move? Every historian would tell you that is absolutely illogical. Don't do it. It won't make sense. It doesn't line up. And what we often miss in our faith is this. Our God is like a good father. He is an incredible parent. And parents, you know this, right? Many of you have bumped up against this question. I'm lucky. My kids are still 3 and 4, and I'm still trying to process what in the world I'm going to say. So if you have great advice, don't hesitate to share that with me. But when your kids for the first time come and ask you the question, where do babies come from? After you say, go ask your father, the answer you give your 5-year-old is vastly different than the answer you give your 15-year-old when you're talking them through the birds and the bees. Am I right? And that answer is vastly different than the answer that would be given to the medical student in medical school. What we miss about a great parent is what we miss about a great God. Our God is in the business, and so often we overlook this imperative truth. Our God is in the business of accommodating to the capacity of his children. He loves us so much that he doesn't speak or operate over our heads. He accommodates to our capacity and our present maturity level. He did this back then. He did this in the Old Testament. He looked at the historical context and what was going on in the world around it, and he accommodated to that because he loved his people enough to try to help them take another step forward and another step forward and another step forward. And when he did that, he created something that still was morally and civilly better and greater than anything else that had been laid down at that time. Any other surrounding nation. And here's why I believe that. Because when you look at the Sinai covenant and those 613 ridiculous laws that God's just trying to get into our business, you know what you find? The theme you find repeated over and over and over again throughout those 613 laws. This is so good. The theme you find repeated over and over in this overarching story is this. It's all about the protections that were afforded to the most vulnerable. And the protections that we see afforded to the most vulnerable at that time in history was absolutely revolutionary. When you look back at the Sinai Covenant, what you're going to find is this. Women were better protected. Servants were better protected. Foreigners were better protected. Children were better protected. Why? Because this God of the Hebrew people was a God who from the very beginning made it clear that each and every human being was created with dignity, value, and worth because they were created in my image, and we need to start moving in that direction. And thousands of years later, guess what? We still haven't gotten fully there, but God was trying to move them there, trying to move them closer. And what we find there for the time was absolutely revolutionary. But then, on the heels of this Sinai covenant, as this nation of Israel finds their promised land, finds their land to rule over, we see the story continue to progress throughout the Old Testament. And we see this moment where the Israelites become very personal to many of us, this moment where the Israelites start to act like all of us do as humanity. And instead of looking to God for like, God, what do you want me to do? God, what's the best decision to make here? God, what direction should I go? You know where the Israelites started to look? Around everybody else. And you know what they saw? Every other surrounding nation has a king. So God, don't we deserve to have a king? That'd be perfect. That would make us like everybody else. And so we'd be able to be good and great like everybody else. And God's like, whoa, 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 guys. Hang on just a second. I know you can't see this because you're busy comparing your own life to everybody else's life, but that's going to end poorly. Here's what's so cool about our God. Freedom of choice. And he allowed them to have freedom of choice, and he relented. And said, if that's what you really want, then that's what you can have. And so they chose to implement kings. And they got all sorts of kings. And what happens with any king? They implemented taxes, and they raised taxes, and they raised up armies, and they went to war, and they got greedy, and they wanted to take what you had so that we could have more of it. And they brought in a whole bunch of wives. And guys, if you hear nothing else, maybe you'll hear this morning. If you have a favorite wife, things won't go well in your life. If you have a favorite wife, things won't go well in your life. And that's what we saw happening throughout the entire course of the history of Israel. They started doing all of these things that they weren't meant to do. And they elevated a human being to a position in which God was only meant to have, and things went haywire. Hello, 21st century application. They implemented somebody into a position in which God was only meant to have and started viewing him as if he should be God and act like God, and everything went haywire from there. But they didn't stop at just the disaster that was kings. Then they got a second bright idea. Not only does every other nation have kings, but every other religion has temples. They've got temples to all their gods. Wouldn't it be cool if we had one? And so let's build a temple. And God's like, what do you need a temple for? I'm not in the temple. I'm a mobile God. Don't believe me? Go back and ask Pharaoh. He'll tell you, I'm a mobile God. I ain't in the middle of that temple. So why are we putting the temple there? Why are we doing all this? And those two choices caused way more harm than they did good. And so what was God's grand idea? I'll send a messenger to help them see where they've gone wrong and to help them get back on track. The first one didn't work, and so he sent another one and another one and another one, and that's where we get the prophets. And when we read through the prophets of the Old Testament, what we find is that their primary responsibility was this. It's for them to look at their present context and their present circumstances and to hand out advice to their people on how they improved, how they got better, how they made changes to get their lives back on track. But every once in a while, we get something absolutely incredible that happens. Every once in a while, from the prophets, we get a moment in which they take themselves out of their present context and they look into future times where one day God will do something through the nation of Israel for the entire world. And one of those, maybe the most incredible one of all, comes in the form of a prophet named Isaiah. Isaiah lived 600 years before the coming of Christ. And Isaiah, in one moment, Isaiah 53, takes himself out of present context. In the other 65 books that Isaiah writes, most of the time he is completely focused on the troubles and the issues that are happening right then, right there. But in the middle, in Isaiah 53, he pulls himself out of that and he looks forward into one day what God will do through the nation of Israel for the entire world. And I wanted to share with you a piece of this because I think what we're going to unveil in this is absolutely earth-shattering for the way in which we look at this book, and more particularly, the way in which we look at the Old Testament. In Isaiah 53, here is what Isaiah wrote. He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. And everyone hearing this or reading this at that time would have said, "Who is he?" But he continues, "For he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so that we could be whole. He was whipped so we could be healed. The Lord laid on him the sins of us all, but he was struck down for the rebellion of my people." And this next part is so incredible. I have to give you the 10-second side note. Remember, 600 years before Christ, and look at the detail that's coming in this next verse. "But he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave." Right down to the detail of Joseph of Arimathea coming and taking him off of the cross and placing him in a tomb that he had purchased, not allowing him to hang up on the cross, not allowing Jesus to be shoveled into a trough like many of the other crucified criminals. No, we get this amount of detail 600 years before the coming of Christ. "When he sees all that is accomplished by his anguish, he will be satisfied." And because of his experience, because of everything that he went through, "my righteous servant will make it possible for many." And we have to stop here because there's a parentheses part that's not written in here that we just need to understand the context. "He will make it possible for many," and the parentheses part is, "who do not deserve to be counted as righteous." Many who have made mistakes, many who are sinners, many who have a checkered past, to be counted as righteous. "For he will bear all their sins." 600 years before the fact, not a trick question, I need your help. Isaiah was writing about Jesus. And for as hard as they try, even the Jewish faith can't negate that everything points to Jesus Christ. There's this incredible story I heard years ago from a seminary professor. And he told a story about his life. And he had grown up in a Jewish household and believed everything that his parents had ever told him about the ancient Hebrew text. And he went away to college and he ended up with the worst thing of all, a Christian roommate. And they had conversation after conversation about the similarities and the difference in their faith. And he said one day, after years of rooming with this guy, he slid this folded up piece of paper across the table to me. And after he left the room, I cracked this piece of paper open, and on the inside was written Isaiah 53. And I read through it, and I was so confused. And I wasn't in my hometown. I was away at college, and so I went through the yellow books, and I found the nearest Jewish synagogue, and I called up the rabbi, and I set up an appointment with him. And I sat down across the desk from him, and as we sat down, I slid across the desk this piece of paper. And the rabbi opened it up, and I said, "What is this? Is this really in our Hebrew Bible?" And the rabbi read it, and he said, "That's Isaiah 53. And the guy's like, well, I didn't know there was a fifth. When I was growing up, we went from 52 to 54. Who is this talking about? And the rabbi looked at him with a smile on his face and he said, sounds an awful lot like Jesus, doesn't it? Except we're Jews, so we just don't accept that. And he said, I went home and I couldn't let that piece of paper go. I couldn't overlook it. I kept reading it and reading it and reading it until I came face to face with this reality, face to face with this truth that you and I have not grasped about the Old Testament, face to face with a truth that he had not grasped about his ancient Hebrew Jewish text. It's something that when we understand it for what it really is, it changes the way in which we view the Old Testament. You see, the Old Testament is simply this. This was the primary purpose. It was one giant reminder that the Jewish people and the Jewish text was always meant to be a divine means to a divine end. That doesn't discount the Jewish faith. It doesn't discount the Jewish people. It's what makes it absolutely incredible. It's what makes it meaningful. If you want your life to be meaningful, become a means to an end. And this is what the Jewish faith was. This is what the Old Testament was. It was simply a divine means to a divine end. And the best summary, the best picture that I could paint for you that I don't want you to lose. And so I put it down, even though it's long, right there on your notes because I wanted you to hang on to it for days, weeks, months, years to come as you struggle with the validity of what the Old Testament really is. The purpose was simply this. It was a story, an account of God wading into the frays of this world and playing by the rules of the kingdoms of this world so that he could introduce a kingdom not of this world. A perfect God who knew better was willing to put it all on the line and play by the rules of the kingdoms of this world. Why? So that at just the right time, he could introduce a kingdom not of this world that would change our lives and change our eternities. Why do we feel like it's necessary to sand off the rough edges of God's behavior that we see in the Old Testament? When we do that, you know what we miss? We miss the mess he waded into. We miss the mess that makes this story so ridiculously powerful in your life and in my life. We miss the mess that he waded into to see the story of redemption come to its fruition at the end of a bloody crucify him story. See, the Old Testament is a saga of ancient people in a messy and broken world who clung to God and he clung to them. But this is what we miss. Being careful not to override their freedom with his presence. Whew! A God who loved his people so much that he was unwilling to override their freedom with his presence. And guys, I get it. This entire Old Testament story is gritty. It's messy. But so much of the power of this story comes from the fact that God was willing to get into the mess. That is a story that puts you at the center of it. That has a purpose of you at the center of it. That no matter what mess you go through, no matter what imperfections you bring to the table, no matter how many times you choose to look at God and say, I don't care what you have to say, I want what everybody else around me has in this moment. That God isn't too big or too scared to get into the middle of your messes, to introduce you into a kingdom not of this world that changes your eternity. And that purpose was 2,200 years in the making. God introduced that promise to Abraham, and it was not realized until a Jewish carpenter found out that his wife was pregnant. And the story began to come to fruition in the perfect way in which Paul summarizes it in his letter to the church in Galatia. In Galatians chapter 4, Paul writes this: "But when the right time came," I love that first line. "But when the right time came," when things were messiest, when things were most out of control, when everybody thought that God was silent because he had been silent for 400 years, when they thought no Messiah was coming, when they thought no help was coming to their side, when the time was just right, God sent his son, born of a woman, subject to the law, adhering to every one of those 613 laws and getting it right every single time. Why? God sent him to buy your freedom and my freedom from that law, so we never had to be slaves to it again. So that he could, and I try not to get emotional, so that he could adopt us as his own children, being made perfect and right in his eyes. The Old Testament was a means to this end. A means, a messy and gritty means to a perfect ending that had you at the center of it. There's no need to feel the need to tidy it up, to make it perfect. Making it perfect takes the power out of it. And when the second century church realized what the true purpose of the story was, you know what their reaction was? This has to be a part of our documentation. This has to be a part of our Bible. It has to be there, because you don't understand the end unless you understand the means. But the question that I have is this: why can't we get there too? Why can't we see the other side of the story and see what's actually going on with our good Heavenly Father that was willing to play to the rules of the kingdoms of this world to introduce something different at just the right time? To not override the freedoms with his presence, but to do something better than that. The reason that we haven't gotten there yet is because we haven't been told the other side of the story. It's because we've been convinced by guys like Richard Dawkins and pieces here and parts there without seeing it in its entirety for what it really is. But the good news is this: now you have. Now you have a bigger picture. Now you have facts and context. Now you know what God was up to. And there's no need to sand off the rough edges, because the rough edges is what makes the ending great. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for being a God who is willing to wade into the frays and the messes of this world, and for a season play by the rules of the kingdoms of this world, so that your story of redemption could see a perfect ending at just the right time. We thank you that the means always had us as the central part of the end of the story. And we thank you for being a God who proved it time and time again throughout the entire Old Testament, that you aren't too big, that you aren't too perfect to get into our messes and to help us find a way out. It's in your name that I pray. Amen. This morning, as we finish part three, I think you know where I'm going. In our expectations every week, I've told you there's not going to be a pretty bow at the end. It's not going to solve every dilemma, every doubt, every question until we get through week four. And the entire puzzle comes together. And what I recognize is this. You don't hear me say this very often. What I recognize is next week is Memorial Day. And there are 1,000 things that are begging for your attention, begging for your Sunday morning schedule. What I believe with all of my heart is that the life change that this book contains hinges on our ability to know that this book is true and to have every piece of that puzzle put together. And so here's what I'm challenging you to. This Memorial Day, would you carve your schedule around part four of this series? For you to get every piece brought together, for you to hear the entire story, and for you to begin to see in its entirety that this book is real. That this book is true, that this book is relevant for what you and I walk through right here, right now in our lives. And so I'm challenging you to be here next week and to bring somebody with you to hear our fourth and final part of this series. Again, we're so excited that you chose to join us and to walk through this deep and difficult journey with us. Have a great rest of your Sunday. We hope to see you soon.